the Battleground State Report with Steve Gill, Michael Patrick Leahy, and Doug Kellett.
And welcome in. This is the Battleground State Report. Go to battlegroundstatenews.com. Battlegroundstatenews.com on the web. Battleground State News on Facebook. Steve Gill, Michael Patrick Leahy here with you this week as we look at some of the news and issues, some of the stories that may be impacting voters, particularly in the battleground states, but nationally as well. President Trump goes to New Hampshire on Thursday night, has a big rally, actually broke the record for the largest attendance at that Manchester arena. Elton John had the previous record, and Donald Trump shows up, breaks the record with more people. He didn't even show up in the big sunglasses and the high-heeled shoes, that the flashy attire, but still had the crowd rocking and rolling. Do these rallies? I mean, again, they make him feel good. They draw media attention. They rev up his base. But are they moving voters who are those independent voters, who are those not really engaged voters? Again, getting that base engaged and involved is important. But is he winning the hearts and minds of those with these rallies who are not necessarily Trump voters? And we've talked before that these are great. Keep doing these. But go do more of visiting mine in Minnesota that was shut down 3 years ago, wasn't open, and is now open and employing people. Go to that factory in these battleground states, in Ohio, in Michigan, in Pennsylvania. Go to those factories. Highlight the fact that they're now opening new areas, that they're getting new business, they're employing more people. Talk to the people who are now employed that were unemployed just a few short years ago. Remind people that we can go back. Remind people that the tax cuts that are putting more into their pocket right now can go away, particularly when you've got the Democrats promising to do so.
Can and will go away. I mean, I think there's no question about that. Now, what I thought was interesting, as you mentioned, Steve, in this rally in New Hampshire this past week, he talked about the Minnesota mines opening up. But talking about it at a rally is one thing. Having the visual of being there at the mine in Minnesota with people working, that's something entirely different.
Having some 55-year-old woman who was unemployed a couple of years ago, who's now employed at a factory, at a shop, at a office that was closed but now is open because of the opportunities, having them say, thank you, President Trump. 3 years ago, I didn't have a job. Three years ago, I was on food stamps. Today, I'm working, and I'm self-sufficient. Thank you. This is what Make America Great means. This is what Keeping America Great means. That's the theme they've got to hammer, and they've got to do it where it's got a personal connection, a visual connection, a local connection.
Absolutely.
And I don't know why his team isn't doing that, frankly.
Well, there are a lot of things we don't know about the Trump campaign. One of the things is, so you're absolutely right in terms of Donald Trump loves these rallies. He's a performer. He's an entertainer, and he loves the adulation that he gets. And he's really great in those rallies. But we come back to the issue of the undecided voters. And the question is really that I would pose to you is, and we've talked about this before, Steve Bannon, our friend, says, you know, this is going to be a mobilization election, not a persuasion election. Clearly, those rallies help mobilize his base. The question, though, is how many undecided voters are there out there?
It's the margins. I mean, that's what one in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan,
yeah,
Minnesota.
Okay.
That's the margin.
Okay. And it's really – it's not the undecided voters in California. It's the undecided voters in Pennsylvania.
50 to 100,000.
Yeah. There's 100,000 people who live in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan who are undecided right now and who are going to determine whether Trump is reelected. Would you agree with that?
I think that's exactly right. And it is getting those 100,000 in each state to pick you.
Yeah.
And then show up and vote. To pick you and then be caring enough about it to also
show up
and vote. I mean, they might decide, I've decided I'm for Trump. But if they sit home and don't go vote, again, we get back to Steve Bannon and the mobilization election. Even if you convince them to be for you, even if you convince them that you're marginally better than the opponent, you still got to convince them that it's marginally important enough to them to get up off their rear ends and go vote.
So two things, and what President Trump has to do is mobilize his base. The rallies do that. But the 100,000 undecided voters who live in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, the way he gets them is he goes into those communities and he goes into his success stories. Click, 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 picture, picture, picture. That's the strategy, right?
And it's not just that they see him at the factory, but the people that are working at that mm-hmm. factory, then they've been personally touched mm-hmm. by the president. Mm-hmm. That story has touched them and their families. So that, again, how do you cobble together that 100,000 that you're trying to reach mm-hmm. and reach them in an emotional way as well mm-hmm. as an intellectual way? That personal contact, that hand-to-hand combat that the left is doing. I mean, they're mobilizing their snowflakes. They're going to have their people pounding door to door in those 7, 8, or 9 really battleground states. I mean, mm-hmm. we're talking about 16 or 17 that can be. Mm-hmm. But in the final 6, 7, or 8 states, people are going to be inundated with these volunteers and mm-hmm. clipboards and T-shirts mm-hmm. coming to their door. That doesn't make the same emotional connection of if the president comes to the factory, hugs your mom, mm-hmm. and she says, thank you for employing me, and then her activation of her kids, her nephews, her nieces, her friends, her neighbors, her church social.
Mom's got women. A job because of President Trump, kids. Go on, vote for President Trump.
And it's like throwing a pebble into a glassy pond. The ripple effect is important. But that yeah. ripple has to be an emotional connection, not just an intellectual. Not just a, well, yeah, my stocks are doing better. My 401k is doing better. The stock market's higher. You got to connect it emotionally. And when you see somebody in your neighborhood, in your community that, oh, I know Miss Jones. She was my 6th grade teacher. Oh, I didn't know she was working at the factory now. That emotional connection is how you move people. And again, I think that in this, we all want to do it by digital. We want to do it by pushing out the memes. You've got all these snowflakes that are working in these campaigns that want to push everything digitally. You've got to make the human contact.
Yep.
President Trump can do it great, but you got to get him out there.
He's got to do it. He's got to do it not just in the rallies.
We'll talk more about it. This is the Battleground State Report. Go to BattlegroundStateNews.com. BattlegroundStateNews.com. Battleground State News on Facebook. And we'll be right back.
It's the Battleground State Report with Steve Gill, Michael Patrick Leahy, and Doug Kellen.
And welcome back in. This is the Battleground State Report, BattlegroundStateNews.com on the web, Battleground State News on Facebook. Steve Gill, Michael Patrick Leahy here with you, as always, talking about how the election's playing out. The president was in New Hampshire, as we mentioned, with that big rally. Also, Elizabeth Warren drawing what the media is saying were huge crowds of a couple of hundred. Look, if President Trump's drawing, 12, 15,000 people inside an arena, several thousand people outside watching on big screen television sets, and Elizabeth Warren draws a few hundred to a rally, trying to put that in the same context is another ridiculous affront to our intelligence by the mainstream media.
But, one of the people who's pushing that, Matt Drudge. That was the headline. You saw a picture of Elizabeth Warren speaking to a couple hundred people, and he said, that was the big above-the-fold lead.
Massive crowd.
Yeah. So the other—
Well, again, when you've got Bill de Blasio drawing 15, literally 1-5, 15 people at the Iowa State Fair where hundreds of thousands are attending. when you have a presidential candidate and the mayor of New York draws 15 yeah. people, that is a minuscule crowd. A couple of hundred is not that many more.
I was at the Iowa State Fair 4 years ago, in 2015. It was a great event. Ted Cruz was there. And I'm telling you, this was when he was, just starting his campaign, and he was just mobbed with people that wanted to talk to him. I mean, it's huge, huge crowds. I mean, hundreds of people surrounding him. You couldn't get near him. And Bill de Blasio only drawn 15. Oh, man. So there's
one of the, by the way, again, these fairs are difficult. And you got to watch, the food you're eating, because how does it look visually? I mean, never eat a corn dog.
Never.
If you're a political candidate at a fair. It just, again, maybe Pete Buttigieg can do that because he's playing to his base. But for most people, do not eat a corn dog at the fair.
Now, that's funny, Steve.
You can eat cotton candy because you're pulling it off. And yeah. You can munch on a lot of things, but you've got to avoid what you eat. And if you go, you had John Kerry, I think it went to Philadelphia to get a Philly cheesesteak and used a knife and fork and was asking whether he could get it with brie rather than cheese whiz. I mean, there are ways to destroy yourself.
That's not an apocryphal story.
But then you had Fred Thompson goes to the Iowa State Fair when he was, you know, getting into the presidential campaign wearing a pair of Gucci loafers. You do not wear Gucci loafers when you're going to the Iowa State Fair or the Texas State Fair or any other state fair where you're likely to step into some bovine secretions.
Do not do that.
Yeah, don't wear your fancy loafers.
So let's talk about Elizabeth Warren, Pocahontas. You know, who basically moved up the legal ladder by falsely claiming to have Native American ancestry, and all the schools that she was part of would make these false reports to the federal government that she was a Native American, which she was not. There's zero evidence documentary at the time, and really zero genetic evidence, even with her disastrous DNA announcement. But there's movement, according to this new poll in Iowa. I want to talk to you about this a little bit. So it's a poll in Iowa that supposedly shows her like with a 10-point lead in the of likely caucus goers in Iowa over Joe Biden. So that's supposedly a big movement. Now, it was done online. First clue that maybe there's some issue there. How, Steve, do you do a poll of caucus goers versus primary voters? How do you do that?
Well, especially when you're looking at caucus goers that are not even going to come out and caucus for about 6 or 8 months from now. Yeah. I mean, it's a long way for somebody to say, oh, yeah, I'm going to be a caucus goer. Now, maybe if you've got a list of folks that have been consistent participants in the Iowa caucuses and you're asking those who participated in 4 out of the last 5 Iowa caucuses over the last 24 years.
Yeah, that's not what
that may
have.
Give you an indication.
This is an online survey done from attendance at the Iowa State Fair.
It's kind of like when they drop the corn kernels and which candidate do you want to vote for? The polling is getting more and more difficult as it is.
Yes.
You know, you have folks that are using cell phones rather than landlines.
Except for the Tennessee Star Triton poll, which has been spot on for 2.5 years, the dozens of so polls that we've done here in Tennessee.
But part of that is because we overpoll when we use Triton. For example, in a statewide poll, we'll poll 1,200 people versus – or 1,200 likely voters in a Republican primary. So you're targeting a specific group versus, you know, we're going to do 600 nationally. You're not going to get very accurate polling data. But also people aren't telling the truth to folks. I mean, you've got a lot of Trump supporters won't even tell their own family members that they're supporting Donald Trump because they don't want the rolling of eyes. Yeah. I can't believe you're for him. I don't like him. You've got a lot of folks that are not willing to stand up and speak up for who they're supporting because they don't want the backlash, particularly in the African-American community, the Latino and Hispanic community. President Trump is going to poll better on Election Day than he's ever going to poll, which is what we saw 4 years ago, where at this same stage of the game, he would be beaten by everybody on the Republican primary side and in the general election.
Right.
Hillary Clinton, in the polls just a few days before the election, was beating Donald Trump handily, which is why all the media were so shocked when he won. So polling is going to be inartful, so to speak, in this election cycle anyway. And then this far out to say, oh, are you going to be a caucus goer? Are you going to show up? Does Elizabeth Warren or do any of these candidates have the ground game because it's going to be cold, it's going to be snowy, it's going to be frigid, it's going to be dark.
First week of February in Iowa, which is the only worst week is the last week of January in Iowa. I mean, I've been to Iowa in January and February.
You almost have to physically drag people out to get them to these caucuses where they then have to sit there for hours.
It's miserable. The roads are cold. The roads are icy. I mean, it's really a bad experience.
And it's not reflective of certainly the demographics of the country. It's not just the outside being white. You know, inside these caucuses will be overwhelmingly white. Same thing with New Hampshire, which is about 98% white. These are not reflective of how somebody's going to prosper as a candidate.
Oh, the other thing about this, it's miserable out. And these things take like 3 or 4 hours of wrangling, and you got to talk to. Can you imagine being in like a gym in Iowa in February or first week of February, trying to talk sense with a Bernie Sanders supporter? Yikes.
Or even if not a high school gym, it may be at somebody's home and there may be like 30 people in some small community.
Yeah.
And you're there wrangling over, you know, how many are going to vote this way. You don't just go in, vote, and leave. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to me, the New Hampshire primary, where you actually show up, vote, and leave, and where candidates have to go engage again in hand-to-hand combat, personal connection for months. I mean, in New Hampshire, you'll have people say, you know, I'm really struggling between candidate A and candidate B. Candidate A has, you know, been in our house, spent the night, and had breakfast with us twice. But, you know, candidate B actually came to our daughter's wedding, has gone to our Little League games. I mean, they have so much more physical contact with the candidates there. And then after that, it goes to all television. And you may have big rallies like Trump does. But the ability to actually get up close and personal, to look somebody in the eye and decide whether or not they're somebody you want to support or not, Iowa and New Hampshire voters get that opportunity.
Yeah, exactly.
But it doesn't reflect what the country is thinking.
Yeah, I think if I had to guess, I mean, because New Hampshire's better than Iowa, but it does have that regional difference, right? Because Elizabeth Warren's from next door Massachusetts. Bernie Sanders is from next door Vermont. So even that is not going to be the best measure of what the Democratic voters want.
Well, and ideologically, Iowa is you know, kind of a farm community. You've got very liberal folks. You've still got Iowa State. You've got those liberal universities. Yeah. It is a more liberal base than kind of would be reflected in most of the Midwest. So it is not, again, reflective of what you might get in Kansas, what you might get in Nebraska. So the primary process is what we have, but it is skewed, and it's a shame that decent candidates get excluded before they really even get any traction, even get started.
You're assuming something there. You said decent candidates.
I mean, historically. There are decent candidates on the Democratic side this cycle.
There might be. This Delaney guy's sort of decent, but he doesn't have a chance.
Tulsi Gabbard may not make the next round of debates. I think they've got 9 that have qualified for the next round of Democratic Party debates. You've got a couple that are trying to scrape their way in. You have to raise a certain amount of money from a certain number of donors and show up with at least 2% in a couple of polls. Right now, I think Tulsi Gabbard has raised the money from the number of donors that she needs, but she's not showing 2% in the polls that would get her into that next round.
Yeah.
You've got to be in the debates, I think, to continue to be a viable candidate.
Well, I think so. Although, you know, I think if you're Tulsi Gabbard and you don't make the debates, you stick with it until Iowa and New Hampshire, I think, you know, because what do you got to lose?
Now, you just had former governor of Colorado Hickenlooper drop out because he realized he's going
and
nowhere.
And the world was crying.
Now they're trying to get him to run for the U.S. Senate against Cory Gardner, figuring that's their best shot to take that Republican seat in Colorado away from the Republicans. Meanwhile, you've got Beto O'Rourke saying, I don't want to be a senator. He spent $79 million running against Ted Cruz, but now
the
he thinks
not
being
good
a senator is beneath him.
So. It's not good enough for
but
him.
But he's so busy changing tires, I'm not sure he has enough time anyway. We're back with more of the Battleground State Report in a moment. BattlegroundStateNews.com, Battleground State News on Facebook. Steve Gill here, Michael Patrick Leahy. We'll be right back.
State Report.
And welcome back in. This is the Battleground State Report. Steve Gill, Michael Patrick Leahy here with you. The latest, and I mean, and I'm a Trump supporter. I'm a Trump fan. I think he is has been one of those change agents that has exceeded even my expectations. But every now and then he comes up with an idea that makes you go, dude, what are you thinking? How is this fitting into your communications plan?
Yeah.
It sounds like a cockamamie scheme to me, although I would hate to have to spell cockamamie, which is why we do this orally instead of in writing. He's now talking about what if we bought Greenland? The island that is part of Denmark. Now, again, he's not the first to come up with this cockamamie scheme. It was floated back in the, you know, 1840s, mid-1800s. It was floated again in the mid-1900s. President Trump thinking, hey, you know, there's a lot of resources up there. There's minerals. There's oil. You know, what would it take for us to buy Greenland? I don't think he's looking at it as, you know, maybe a Trump hotel site, another casino run. But is why do they even come up with and push this out there? I mean, or does the president just casually mention stuff and then, you know, again, the leak filter out of his own administration starts pushing it out there?
So Greenland has responded. I kind of like the idea. I think it's kind of fun. But Greenland has responded, according to the BBC, Steve. And they responded. They said the foreign ministry responded, said, quote, "We're open for business, not for sale."
Well, nobody's doing business with them, though. That's their problem.
All 56,000 Greenlanders. Is that what you're saying, Greenlanders?
There's only 56,000 people in the whole island, right?
It's the largest island in the world, though. But it's pretty darn cold.
Well, and they're saying, well, this is colonialism at work. He's wanting to – no, if we were doing it the old-fashioned way, we would simply go, well, take it. Militarily, I think we could beat Denmark.
So here's the scoop on Greenland. Pressing story, pressing issue here. 56,000 people concentrated around the coastline. Almost 90% are indigenous Greenlandic Inuit people. It has a limited self-government and its own parliament. The premier, Kim Kielsen, has not commented. Why do you think Donald Trump wants to do this, Steve? Because it has coal, zinc, copper, and iron ore. Of course, the Democrats will oppose it because the coal is, you know, evil.
Well, why aren't the Denmarkians, you know, exploiting their own resources? Because of the same reason we didn't until President Trump became, you know, president. We are now an oil exporting country because we've gone in, gotten our own resources, and allowed development of our minerals, of our oil, you know, over the screams and howls of the Democrats. And I expect that Denmark is a socialist, left leaning, country as well. Why? I mean, again, you look at Alaska. They're actually sending checks to people, in pretty large numbers because they get the oil out and the people in the state actually get money. You would think these 56,000 mainly Inuits, Eskimos as we used to call them when I was a kid, when I lived in Alaska, you would think they would be demanding, how come Alaskans get the resources and get money and we don't?
Apparently
they don't have good internet service and nobody knows what Alaska's getting.
Apparently in Greenland, these 56,000 people have high rates of suicide, alcoholism, and unemployment. But they don't want the U.S. to buy them.
Yeah, Denmark wants to keep them. We kind of like it this way. This is a good deal for us. We've got a bunch of, you know, drunk, suicidal Eskimos living on a flat sheet of ice, and we don't want anything to change that.
There's lots of coal and zinc and other natural resources there. So.
Polar bears and seals and walruses.
Yeah, maybe you put an NFL franchise up there and call them, you know, the Greenland Polar Bears.
Actually, you could probably do hockey, and you not even have to, you know,
you
do an
hockey.
Ice rink. You just play out in the field.
There's just too much fun on Greenland. I love the story. The reason I love the story is it's so out of the blue, and it breaks up all of this monotonous. Racist allegations that this is what the campaign's about, right? Trump is racist. No, he's not. Trump is racist. No, he's not. Boy, that's pretty dull.
There's, you know, of course he's racist. He wants to buy a place that's covered in white snow.
There you go.
You know, he's not looking to buy black land. He's looking to buy green land. You know, which has
covered in white.
You know, Eskimos on it. it does underline that Jeffrey Epstein might have been a pervert, might have been a pedophile, but he was smart enough to have an island in the Caribbean where it was warm and nice, rather than in Greenland where it's ice and snow.
Denmark has weighed in. Okay, this is the foreign affairs spokesman for the populist Danish People's Party, Soren Espersen. This is Soren Espersen.
Soren Espersen
said of President Trump, if he is truly contemplating this, then this is final proof that he has gone mad.
He's a real estate developer. He sees real estates being undeveloped. He's going, hey, we could do something with that. How come nobody's doing anything with that? I mean, I think it's pretty far reaching of him to, you know, raise the issue. And next thing you're going to be hearing is people in Denmark are going, I don't know that we should sell it to the Americans, but why aren't we developing it? Why aren't we a more prosperous country by getting the resources out? Why are we having these people that are living there in poverty, in suicidal context, in alcoholism? Why aren't we doing something? You know, let's make Greenland great again.
Make Greenland great again. So China actually tried to develop 3 airports in Greenland last year, and that was shut down.
It's because they knew Hong Kong Airport was going to get shut down. They'd have to be able to get in and out of their country.
They're going
to
transport all the Hong Kong folks into Greenland. See, this is why I love this story, because it's a fun story. You can laugh about it, and you're not caught up in all of this.
I mean, I don't think he's sent over a written offer to the Denmark Parliament. I mean, if this story's getting more attention, and again, we're playing with it because it's just fun.
It's fun,
but it's not like the president sent over an offer, you know, and has, you know, a real estate broker trying to figure out the terms of the escrow agreement.
In 1946, Harry Truman offered Denmark $100 million. $100 million for Greenland. They turned it down.
See, they would have been better off to have taken the money. They would have been. Done with it since.
They haven't done a lot with Greenland.
They've, I think, got in 1847. First of all,
1946 was
Harry Truman actually did a dollar figure. I mean, President Trump just said, "Hey, what would it take for us to buy it?" I think in the 1840s there was another stab at why don't we buy Greenland? You know, you'd had the Seward's folly. We bought Alaska. Hey, what's something else that's cold and north that we could go in and maybe buy on a lease purchase agreement? $100 million to Denmark. I don't know what their GDP is, but $100 million in 1947. $7 would have been a sizable chunk.
Yes, it would have been, and Denmark would have been better off, actually, had they sold Greenland to us for $100 million, because they're doing nothing with it.
Parts of Canada are going, look, we'll come to you for free if you'll just get us out of this Canadian government thing. You've got really the same sort of thing in Canada that you do in Pennsylvania. In Pennsylvania, you've got Pittsburgh and Philadelphia with ideologically and politically Alabama in between. Mm-hmm. You really kind of have the same thing in Canada. You've got, you know, Quebec on one side. Yeah. You've got Toronto.
Yep.
And then you've got the far west.
Yeah, Alberta and Manitoba and Saskatchewan are very conservative populist.
Yeah, in between you've got Alabama.
Yeah, exactly. Alabama up north. And, of course, I was just back up, just back up in Hemingford, Quebec, where my great-great-grandfather built a cabin in the 1840s. It's still standing.
Yeah, we'd take the parts of Canada that don't speak French. That would be the parts that we would want. And Greenland, you know, again.
What do they speak up there? Inuit, Eskimo, Danish?
I'm not sure that we've got to buy it from Denmark. What if you just went in with offers? I mean, you've got massive tracts of land you could probably buy for like $3 an acre. Yeah. We could probably get
the whole thing
for less than $100 million now just going out and buying
it. We could just buy the land, right? Yeah, that's not a bad idea.
As long as Denmark would let you have the mining and oil rights.
My guess is probably Denmark owns like 95% of the land there, right?
Why they're not getting any oil, minerals, or coal or anything else out of the ground.
Good point.
And again, the folks in Denmark, this may actually raise their attention level to go, why aren't we exploiting our own resources and paying lower taxes because we've got oil underground over there? I mean, you got Arab sheiks that are driving around in gold-plated BMWs and Mercedes.
The Inuit want to be driving around in limousines.
At least get a Prius.
Really?
We'll be right back with more. This is the Tennessee Star Report. I'm sorry, this is the Battleground State Report, battlegroundstatenews.com, Battleground State News on Facebook, and we'll be right back with more.
Battleground State Report with Steve Gill, Michael Patrick Leahy, and Doug Kellett.
And welcome back to the Battleground State Report. Michael Patrick Leahy and Steve Gill closing out the hour, and we just got talking. We got off on a tangent, but a fun tangent, talking about buying Greenland. And it's just so much fun for me to talk about that because I'm so tired of all of the Democratic, you know, predictable, we need gun control. We need to get rid of all these white supremacists. And as Steve mentioned in the last segment, obviously this is a part of a white supremacy plan because, you know, Greenland is covered. Greenland is totally covered, 95% covered in white ice. So that's just kind of funny. I wonder if they will call that Trump's folly, right? Because if he may not even be serious about it. I don't know. We will follow up that story as it develops. And I hope there's more to report on because, you know, you just got to have this kind of fun every now and then. By the way, so we're talking a little bit earlier. We were talking about, you know, what's going to determine the outcome of this 2020 presidential election. I guess it's the only thing we can talk about, right, between now and November of 2020. And I think we've concluded that there are the two things that have to happen. Number one, you got to get the base out. This is, as Steve Bannon says, a persuasion, a mobilization election, not a persuasion election. And so you got to get the base out. So President Trump's doing a really good job with his rallies on that. There's a little bit more than that. There are some folks that matter. And if you look at the Electoral College map, you know, three states hold the key. Three states hold the key. Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And they have a total of 46 Electoral College votes. Now, President Trump won. He on Election Day, he got 306 Electoral College votes to 232 for Hillary Clinton, even though he lost the popular vote by 2% because of the way they were spread out. It was a very solid Electoral College victory, but about 100,000 votes differential in those three states, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, made the difference. Had he lost those three states, we would now be talking about President – oh, please, no. It would have been President Hillary Clinton. President Trump would have had 260 Electoral College votes. She would have had 278, and she would have been President of the United States. So there's 100,000 votes. I think it was like 10,000 in Michigan, 11,000 in Michigan, about 20,000 in Wisconsin, and about 60,000 in Pennsylvania. I may be off a little bit on that, but that's about the differential. Well, it's 100,000 undecided voters in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania that are going to make the difference. And, persuading those folks is really going to be a key issue, I think. Now, we're talking about Michigan. Michigan is a state that in some respects, because, you know, we have our company, Star News Digital Media, owns five news sites. In addition to the Battleground State News.com, we own the Tennessee Star, the Ohio Star, the Michigan Star, and the Minnesota Sun. And, looking at those states, each state is different. Michigan actually, sort of politically, is more like Tennessee than any of the other states, surprisingly. It's got a very active, aggressive, grassroots populist conservative movement. And there's a story in BattlegroundStateNews.com that I think you'll find very interesting to talk about some of the issues that matter in Michigan. A teacher there wrote a piece at American Thinker that we wrote a story about. Michigan teacher says public schools, quote, worse than ever, dominated by, quote, outrage culture. Lawrence Ludlow, he's a guy who holds a master's degree in medieval studies and has taught in Detroit and Grosse Pointe area, recently wrote an article about his experiences returning to the classroom. So here's the story. He said he was a semi-retired business writer who taught in Detroit 35 years ago and returned to the classroom because a local high school was unable to replace a Latin teacher who had resigned. So he kind of stepped in. So he wrote at the American Thinker, once in class, I witnessed firsthand the politicized atmosphere of today's factory-style government monopoly schools. And this is a place called Grosse Pointe. Grosse Pointe is an affluent suburb of Detroit. And here's what he wrote. He said, within a few days, it was clear that many students did not understand English grammar, much less Latin fundamentals. Students did not bring books to class, relentlessly complained about homework, and expected high grades regardless of proficiency. And he, when asked questions, he uncovered what he says were some alarming facts. Here, listen to this. Here were the facts. Latin was a dumping ground for students who already had failed another language, and, quote, picking up a few phrases, end quote, was the goal. Many teachers expected little but awarded high grades. Students were subjected to parental pressure to obtain good grades regardless of performance. One department head at this school had been demoted for teaching at a pre-college level and refusing to lower his standards. Senior teachers, people who were experienced, were dropping out in disgust, and younger teachers had no choice but to accept the situation. Under parental pressure, the principal was establishing a process to prevent students from having to take more than one test on the same day. So he went on and basically said the following. I'm going to quote this. Quote, subjected to this one-sided feedback, administrators tacitly urge teachers to lower standards despite proclaiming the opposite in public. Like the dodo in Lewis Carroll's Alice's Adventure in Wonderland, everybody has won and all must have prizes. Austrian economists, however, explained this behavior. Ludwig von Mises, for example, noted the human tendency to place a high value on receiving something sooner rather than later. He called this time preference series. The illusion, he says, of competence explains why, despite falling student enrollment, Grosse Pointe and similar school districts succeed in raising school taxes. Now, you know, we had a discussion in one of our earlier programs about the utter demise of public education in America. And we saw this, and one of my pet themes is we are raising in our public schools, we have one kind of apprenticeship. It's not for apprenticeship to become a welder. It's not apprenticeship to become a plumber. It's not an apprenticeship to become a carpenter. It is an apprenticeship to become a social justice warrior, to go out and protest and, you know, raise your voice to support a left-wing ideology. That's basically the only skill, if you will. It's not really a skill that public schools are developing now. What I found very interesting is that this is something that the actor John Ratzenberger has talked about. You know who John Ratzenberger is? He's a guy who played Cliffy. Hey, Cliffy, on Cheers, and then for a period of time, he did a cable TV show called Made in America, where he talked about this. And I didn't know this about John. He actually is a he was a journeyman carpenter, and one of his themes is, you know, we've stopped having shop classes. About 30 years ago, they started shutting down the shop classes. Now, my dad, back in the late 1950s, early 1960s, got his start as a teacher of industrial arts of shop, because he was a kid who grew up on a farm, and on a farm you have to figure out, you know, you can't order a new machine, you don't have enough money, you have to learn how to fix it. So he had great experience in farm equipment and understanding how to make it work. And so, you know, I share this sentiment. I think where we need to be as a country is kids in high school, whether you're going to college, whether you're going to a trade school afterwards, every kid should learn basic skills of how to make things, build things, and fix things and solve problems. That's what shop class was designed to do, woodworking and metal shop. But what we've seen over the past 30 years, there was a time, 50s, 60s, when everybody went to shop class. Not so much anymore. In fact, if you look around the country, shop classes are few and far between. Only two states right now, Minnesota and Wisconsin, offer shop in pretty much every high school. We've talked to some of the teachers there at the shop classes in Minnesota, and they've said, you know, we're kind of struggling even here because getting public resources for shop classes is more difficult. This is, you know, the shift among the teachers' unions and all the education bureaucracy is to quote of, you know, get college prep, which is basically regurgitating sort of left-wing propaganda in many instances, and not to develop a skill. So it was interesting. He appeared, John Ratzenberger, has got a new venture going and to provide information to or marketing services to American-made companies, and these called American-made manufacturing, something like that. Anyway, so this is what he said on Fox and Friends, and I think this is kind of interesting. He said, quote, they, the schools, also canceled shop classes about 30 years ago, just wiped them out, and who knows, maybe it was political because you don't give people skills that if you don't give people skills, they have to rely on the government. But if you give them skills, they don't need the government. Now, think about that for a minute. I think that makes an awful lot of sense. I don't know if the educational bureaucrats sat down in a room and said, yeah, let's crank out a whole bunch of unskilled kids. But the reality is, I mean, just look at it. Kids in high school today, I mean, basic life skills they don't know. How many kids in high school actually know how to even change a tire? They're not being taught this stuff, and it's important life skills. And so I think this is a very good argument. In fact, we at our company, Star News Digital Media, you know, we, in addition to owning and operating these news sites around the country and the radio show, we are do textbooks. We have a textbook coming out, Star News Digital Media Guide to Shop and Engineering for Secondary School Students, an Introduction to Industrial Arts. This is going to be great. It'll be out in September. If you're interested in putting a shop program in your school, check out our website, starnewsdigitalmedia.com, starnewsdigitalmedia.com. You can see how to order that book. And also you can see what you need to do if you want to reintroduce shop to your local high school. Hey, great talking to you today. It's been a great program. And Battleground State News is here on can heard every weekend and on 98.3 FM and 1510 AM in Nashville. It's 6 AM every Saturday. We'll be back next Saturday. Thanks for listening to us.